My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. Over the last 5 years, the Bitcoin Conference has become the world's largest gathering of Bitcoiners. From breaking announcements and international media coverage to countless meaningful talks by thought leaders and industry innovators, we are excited to continue our drive for global hyper-Bitcoinization. From July 25th to the 27th, 2024, we'll be taking the Bitcoin Conference to the city of Music and Freedom, Nashville, Tennessee. Join thousands of attendees for countless opportunities to learn, engage, and network across 3 days of pure Bitcoin signal. Get your tickets now for the best price at b.tc/conference. You are not going to want to miss what Nashville has in store. My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. In its inaugural year, Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history. Held from October 12th to the 14th in 2022 at Westergaas Event Forum, nearly 3,000 attendees jumped at the opportunity to learn, engage, and party with fellow Bitcoiners. 126 brilliant speakers from all over Europe and beyond took the stage to represent different angles and present various perspectives. Offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages, we are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Block yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.
What's up, Spencer? What's up, Matt? How's it going?
Hey, Chris. Appreciate you hosting, man. It's going great. Really looking forward to having Matt on the podcast today. That's going to be a lot of fun talking about UFOs, UAPs, aliens, technology, and a little bit of how information is disseminated throughout society and all that in the context of everything that's come to light lately. But yeah, really excited for this. Matt, how's it going, man?
How's it going? Yeah, thanks for having me. Should be a fun convo.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's going to be useful for people just to understand how to contextualize everything that's come up lately, especially the kind of Grush revelations. And, you know, I guess speaking for myself, I haven't seen any definitive proof that what he says is correct, but I think it's going to be good for people to understand how to really like understand the credibility of sources and also you're thinking in terms of probabilities, which I know we talked a little bit last time about your framework on how to understand the probabilities of different explanations for all this information. But yeah, before we get into that, I just want to say it was really nice meeting you in Miami, Matt. And we had a little bit of a conversation about UAPs and alien technology, which was a lot of fun. And you did ask me a pretty interesting question, like, you know, if it was indeed true that aliens are or extraterrestrial life or advanced technology have indeed been recovered and reverse engineered or accessible, like, you know, what would that mean for markets and how would you express that view? So when all this Grush stuff came up, I was like, okay, we got to get Matt on Cosmic Bitcoin and take his brain. So yeah, really looking forward to it.
Certainly, there's a few rabbit holes you just opened up there. Happy to dive down as much as you want.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. And I guess I'll also just say, you know, this conversation and more like it on Cosmic Bitcoin are made possible by the Bitcoin Conference. And we're gearing up right now for Bitcoin Amsterdam, October 12th through the 13th. We have a link to get your early bird tickets before prices increase. And really looking forward to seeing everyone out there and as well as in Nashville next year. So should be a lot of fun. And, you know, Bitcoin's pumping right now. It's been interesting to watch all of that unfold with, you know, all the spot ETF applications and whatnot. But with that aside, I think it would probably be good just to do a quick review of, Matt, how you understand, you know, the different explanations for what UAPs are, and that'll give us a good jumping off point for, you know, how to understand those probabilities. And so I have it pinned up in the nest, but, you know, you talk about explanations of UAPs as being of four types, whether that is systematic error, systematic deception, secret human technology, or non-human technology. And so I guess it'd be good for you to just offer a little bit more context on what those mean. And then after that, we can kind of dig into like how you understand those probabilities and how you update your model for those probabilities as new information comes to light. But yeah, I guess, first of all, like, so when there's, you know, images like these Tic Tacs that David Fravor, I believe that's his name, Fravor, has identified an Air Force pilot off the coast of California. He's, you know, sees this Tic Tac object moving at speeds we can't really reproduce given our technological capabilities today. And, you know, the kind of the easy explanation would be, oh, that those things exist out there, that is what happened and was recorded. And so is there an explanation as to how that could not be the case? Like what types of systematic error exist out there?
Certainly. So I'll come back to that question. But first, I guess I should address, like, why am I talking about this? Right? Like,
yeah. Well,
why does anyone care what I have to say about this topic? And not saying anyone should care about what I have to say about this topic. It's certainly not within my professional ambit explicitly. But, you know, at least I think about it in a larger kind of intellectual framework that I've developed over the past, you know, 15 years or so. And so, yeah, kind of like what motivates my attention to this issue, I think is maybe a good place to start. And then I can sort of set up how I would think about thinking about this stuff. So I started, you know, academically focused on physics and philosophy. So I was always like attuned intellectually towards kind of the deeper questions as everyone, you know, eventually confronts the realities of choosing a profession. I steered away from a PhD track and kind of went into kind of the policy and national security space, and then spent about 10 or 12 years doing consulting for the government on that national security stuff, explicitly looking at kind of low probability, high consequence events of the maybe more kind of normal variety. So things like cyber attacks, nuclear war, pandemics, earthquakes, all those sorts of bad scenarios, right? That most in our everyday waking life, we don't have to think about, but, you know, systems of government and institutions have to sort of think about those parts of the probability distribution that are kind of in the tails. And so sort of intellectually and professionally, I guess I found myself with a mental model that is always looking towards those sort of corners of the distribution, those sorts of odd things. And I think, you know, everyone kind of got a firsthand, you know, experience with those sorts of, you know, left tails of the distribution when COVID happened, right? And so if you mm-hmm. were paying attention like acutely to, you know, early reports in January of 2020 about something happening in Wuhan, you know, it was very hard to kind of parse the evidence, right? Like, is this something to be concerned about? Is this something real? You know, is this being hyped? Is this like the end of the world, right? Like, when you have these sorts of events occur that are very rare, or that seem to sort of break the normal model of how people approach, you know, thinking about the future, it's very hard to sort of repurpose your existing toolkit and to try to, you know, get a grip on what's going on. And so I think while they're not, you know, exactly identical, right, the growth pattern of a virus is certainly very different than trying to unpack whatever we think is going on with UAPs. But from like an intellectual perspective, that's kind of like, I put them in that larger box, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like why I think about this issue, why I pay attention to it. It's just because I have this sort of intellectual curiosity, and professionally I'm always thinking about these sorts of low probability, high consequence events. And of course, you know, if this were true, if it turned out that UAPs represented non-human technology in our presence, that would kind of be the ultimate low probability, high consequence event. So I think it behooves us to think through it systematically, rigorously, and, you know, to try to shed as much sort of psychological and social taboo and sort of the cruft of kind of the, you know, pop culture around this topic to try to take it seriously as an issue to analyze. So the framework I would, you know, I sort of recommend in general, right, for thinking rationally is sort of a Bayesian approach where, you know, you always hold somewhat loosely to any given proposition. You always try to assess, you know, why you believe something, like what relevant set of background facts, mental models about how the way the world works, you know, motivate, you know, ascribing credences to a set of beliefs. And so I think you should apply that in all facets of life, and everyone's responsible for their own credences and for doing their own, you know, choosing what sorts of sort of ground truths to base their credences on, and to, you know, always treat their beliefs as things that need to be updated and revised over time, not to become so wedded or dogmatic about any particular set of beliefs, and sort of be open to evidence as a function of changing one's mind. And so I think you should apply that to UAPs. And so I think the way to start about thinking about UAPs is, okay, one, they're a phenomenon that needs to be explained. It might end up being a fictitious phenomenon. I think we can maybe rule that out now, but you could, you know, maybe not there yet. Maybe you would still think that it's an entirely fictitious phenomenon, but you would have to explain, well, why is it, you know, a thing at all that is in sort of the popular discourse? And you would want to ascribe, you know, certain credences to four possible explanations. So I think there's four explanations that really exhaust all the ways you could explain UAPs. And they're not mutually exclusive, but they, I would say, are comprehensively exhaustive, right? So if you're familiar with kind of like the MISI framework. So yeah, there's either systematic error, systematic deception, secret human technology, or real non-human technology. So I think those are the four possibilities. And so to your example, like the David Faber example, kind of using that as a lens maybe to piece through these four different kind of candidate classes of explanation, systematic error would point you in the direction of looking at, okay, all the different sensors, both technical sensors as well as, you know, human sensors, eyeballs processing the information that are reporting, you know, an apparent object displaying aerodynamic capabilities that are, you know, far exceed anything in like the known inventory of a military. And so if those sensors are reporting, you know, an object that seems to display those capabilities, the class of explanations in systematic error would say, well, they're all malfunctioning, right? They're malfunctioning systematically in the sense that they're giving mutually consistent reports of something that just isn't there. So in the class of explanations that fit under category one, there are no real objects that UAPs describe. They are just the label we give to phenomenon that are the result of systematic error of some kind. The second class of explanation, systematic deception, would point you towards a story that you would construct that says, it's not the sensors that are malfunctioning, it's that there's some coordinated deception operation. David Faber is being paid to say these things, and all the other people around him, all the other pilots and other sort of witnesses on the various other sort of naval craft in that area, and the people that have come forward on this topic over decades, you know, telling this set of stories and providing, you know, various first and secondhand hearsay evidence about this topic, they're all part of some deception operation. It's a coordinated, you know, sort of psychological operation for some particular purpose. And there's a group that's coordinating this over long periods of time and has, you know, large amounts of resources at their disposal to make people believe this is a real thing. And so that is what you would have to construct as a prior for, you know, motivating something like explanation set two, systematic deception. And that, you know, one and two both share the common feature that UAPs as a label for something don't actually refer to real technology. They refer to some set of beliefs, whether they're constructed as a result of, you know, systematic malfunction of sensors or systematic deception operations connected by some group for a particular purpose. Then you get into category three explanation, which is this is a secret human technology that actually UAPs represent a real physical object, a real craft that actually has the observed capabilities that it has, but it's actually, you know, constructed and operated by humans. You could, you know, point to candidate secret human groups, whether those are U.S. military intelligence groups or other foreign nations that, you know, have achieved some groundbreaking technology breakthrough that allows them to construct these vehicles that display these capabilities. And then category four is anything that's not category three, that's not the other three, right? So it just says non-human technology. It's some real object, some real, you know, thing, physical thing that displays these capabilities, but it is not a human derived technology. That's as far as you go for category four. Category four, of course, branches into many, many different, you know, separate trees of explanation for what exactly is the, you know, the origin of that non-human technology. And that gets you into, you know, very, very different, you know, sets of the sort of Bayesian analysis. But that's how I would start, sort of setting up those four categories of explanation and then trying to look for evidence, you know, systematically investigate, you know, claims on each of those four, try to rule out, you know, what you can, and then, you know, update over time. So that's kind of the way I would start.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thanks for that. And I think personally, like what I struggle with is like, how do I assign probabilities to any of these? And I think, you know, there's also a possibility that say options one and two, both systematic error and systematic deception could also be like kind of commingled, you know, where there could be systematic error that is enforced via systematic deception. Like say there's a backdoor into our detection technology, and that can be manipulated to, you know, say David Fravor is not a paid actor and he's, you know, reading these sensors, yet those sensors were intentionally constructed in a way where they were then deceptive. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, like, to my mind, I just think of it as being so difficult to consider what these probabilities are, and especially also for number two, like, it just leads down so much murky water. Like, how do I say this? I mean, there's you can always come up with a reason that, you know, these Grush reports could be coming to light now for a specific reason. And, you know, you could come up with a multitude of reasons as to why that would be advantageous for a certain group. I mean, this is, you know, not the belief that I hold, but necessarily, but, like, you know, it was right at the time of, you know, these debt ceiling negotiations. And at the same time, you have this explosive report in the media. There's a lot of, you know, fanfare being made around it. And, you know, it is also the case that Grush is a part, I guess, previously was a part of the government and is associated with those people. And so, you know, there could be mm-hmm. a confluence of incentives there. So, you know, I'm not sure if
yeah.
this is,
yeah. 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 So the way I would, like, so I think you're right. Like, you can theorize till the cows come home, right? My mm-hmm. point is, though, like, ultimately you have to look at facts and you have to adjudicate, you know, ultimately, you know, yourself, which facts you treat as trustworthy to then update on, right? Because, yeah, you can construct all sorts of, you know, plausible just-so stories. And that's kind of what I was just doing with the David Fravor thing. But those were just constructing plausible just-so stories to sort of motivate how you would construct a prior for each of those four. But a prior is just where you start. Then you actually have to construct, you know, you have to update. And to update, you actually have to look at the relevant facts. And to acquire the relevant facts, you have to undertake, you know, serious investigation. So I don't think you can, you know, you can, you know, come up with all sorts of plausible stories in your head that can mm-hmm. account for lots of different things. The only thing that resolves the issue ultimately is going out and, you know, finding facts that you treat as relatively trustworthy and putting as much weight as you ascribe to that to update on. So to that particular example of, okay, is the timing coincidental? Could there be other motivations, right? Okay, that's like a candidate explanation that you would resolve by looking at the facts around what was the timing associated with the story coming out? What was the timing associated with the say, like, high confidence associated with the facts around Grush particularly, right? And so you can investigate that and you can find, for example, that he was in the position that he was in. He was assigned to the UAP task force in 2019 as the national kind of technical intelligence sort of integrator for the National Reconnaissance Office. At the same time, I think he flipped over to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So he had this particular role, very senior intelligence position. He was assigned to the UAP task force before National Defense Authorization Act turned it into a formal office. And over that course of those 2.5 years, he was, you know, conducting these investigations, doing these interviews with individuals throughout the government to, you know, basically do the mission that Congress tasked DOD with doing, which is, you know, collecting information from the government on UAPs. So that was the statutory requirement, basically. And then he found things, you know, allegedly, this is what's reported. Mm-hmm. And he made a documented complaint to the DOD's Inspector General in July of 2021 that he alleges he was subject to reprisal as a result of filing that complaint. And then filed a complaint to the Intelligence Community Inspector General, a separate, you know, Inspector General for the IC in, I believe it was June or May of 2022. And that, when that got filed, the Inspector General and the Intelligence Community did their investigation. They brought in witnesses from the rest of the Intelligence Community and DOD to try to corroborate or substantiate his allegations of both the underlying core claims as well as the claims of reprisal, and then made a determination that it was, quote, credible and urgent, which is more of a statutory definition of, you know, does it meet the definition of something that needs to be reported to the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, and to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, the HPSI, and the SSCI, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And they made that determination, they made those referrals. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence each took in-camera testimony under oath from him, as well as a number of other whistleblowers or witnesses to his claims. Apparently, you know, 11 hours of total testimony between those two legislative bodies, as well as maybe 7 hours of testimony taken just by Grush to the Inspector General, if not more. And then we hear, you know, that he comes out and is, you know, a real person. So, like, you can look at the timing of that. Like, I went through that whole story just to, like, give you the example of, you can come up with a plausible explanation for why are we hearing this now? Oh, it's coincidental with this other thing in the news that we think is quote unquote a distraction of. And that's like, okay, that's like a plausible story. And then you're like, okay, well, let's investigate the timing to see if it is a coincidence or if it's, you know, nefarious. You look at the timing, and the reported timing is this didn't start now. This started, you know, many years ago, and it's been just a process unfolding behind our view, and we're only seeing, you know, it reach a certain point in the public now. So that's like, that's just like one example of where, you know, you can come up with all sorts of, you know, theories of a particular explanation, but you actually have to go out and look at the relevant facts, trust at least the sources to the extent that you trust them, and then weigh the evidence as you find it.
Introducing the Gatekeepers issue, the Q1 2023 print release from Bitcoin Magazine. The winter editorial serves as both a reminder of the sacrifice whistleblowers have made in the pursuit of truth and the call to arms for a new generation. Order it now from BitcoinMagazine.com. There's a thin line between curation and censorship. There is an even thinner line between moderation and constitutional violation. The Gatekeepers issue explores the liminal space between these nuances, painting the fences worthy of demolition and those deserving respect. Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Subscribe today for exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Don't miss out on this piece of Bitcoin history. Subscribe now at store.bitcoinmagazine.com. Bitcoiners, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com and embark on a path towards Bitcoin mastery. Get ready to seize every opportunity in the market with Bitcoin Magazine Pro today.
On that point of trusting sources, I think this could be like a good jumping off point for how to understand information that's being presented to the public, information that is emanating in the discourse. And, you know, I think you could provide some insight here is like, what is the nature of communication and dissemination of information between the government and the public? And, you know, is that like dichotomy of, you know, the government and the public, is that, you know, a correct dichotomy to make? And it I guess some kind of putting the cart before the horse here, but like, is that, you know, it seems to me that, there's like a kind of, it's not monolithic. Like there are so many factions operating with inside governmental agencies in the intelligence community. And how do you understand that relationship? And for context, it seems as though there's kind of a little bit of a conflict going on between Congress and these more clandestine programs that they're trying to understand, you know, these retrieval missions that allegedly exist, and you know what they've been led to believe previously. So how do you understand that? Like, do you have a framework for understanding that information flow?
Yeah, and this is actually why like the UAP topic is such a thorny issue, and I think Grush's case unpacks this in like all the gory, complicated detail. Because if you just take it face value, if you sort of just grant for the sake of argument that what he's saying is true, right? Then you have to put yourself in the position of looking at kind of the different bureaucratic challenges that are then created, right? Because what he's alleging, and it, you know, for the purposes of this sort of analysis, we're stipulating to be true, is that there were some elements of the military and intelligence community, you know, including their contractors, you know, like the big defense contractors and intelligence contractors, that were using legal existing what are called special access programs, which are, you know, the kind of bureaucratic construction that the government uses to protect the most sensitive, both defense and intelligence information. So in the DoD, it's called special access programs. In the intelligence community, it's called controlled access programs, you know, SAPs and CAPs. There's a whole bureaucratic structure. And in the U.S. government, you know, post the 1970s kind of intelligence reforms, after seeing all the shenanigans that the CIA was up to in the 50s and 60s, there was a church committee, a whole bunch of reforms that tried to put in place more mechanisms of accountability to Congress for the activities of the intelligence community and the military. And so in that world of SAPs and CAPs, which is very shrouded from public view and from our adversaries intentionally, there are certain individuals in the Senate Select Committee Intelligence and the House Purpose Select Committee Intelligence that get granted access to certain of these programs. there's a whole hierarchy of them. There's saps, normal saps. There's unacknowledged saps. And there's waived unacknowledged saps. Basically, you know, they get progressively harder to understand, like, exactly what's happening. But to your question about, like where does that fit in with Rush's claim? So he's alleging that potentially some of these existing either waived or just unacknowledged special access programs that potentially relate to programs relating to, say, foreign technology retrieval and reverse engineering. So you can imagine a Russian satellite falls out of, you know, orbit, crashes somewhere. We want to, you know, go get it and figure out, you know, like what it can do, right? That seems like a pretty, you know, understandable classified activity that the U.S. government would have. That would have essentially, you know, a special access program. Its activities and its budget would be, you know, overseen by Congress. He's alleging is that potentially those programs were being used illegally as cover for doing similar activities, crash retrievals and reverse engineering, but for UAPs, for non-human derived technology. And so if you're in Congress and you hear that, you've got some challenges on your hand, right? Because if you're assuming it's true, one, it's coming to you from someone who is making this disclosure through like the legal protections of a whistleblower complaint, which in like the bureaucratic structure of the government sort of means you can't just like challenge the witness, right? He's potentially alleging, you know, government malfeasance could turn into evidence that needs to go into, you know, a Department of Justice criminal referral, right? He's saying that laws were broken. He's saying that individuals he's aware of inside the government, you know, lied to Congress, misappropriated funds, potentially did other, you know, like illegal things. And Congress not only has to, you know, do their due diligence to investigate this, but it potentially, if it's true, that could be Department of Justice referrals. And so they do not want to get crosswise with a potential, you know, like legal investigation and be, you know, there's a whole kind of insulating the sort of political sphere from these sorts of investigations, as we've seen in the past. These can get very contentious. So you've got kind of the traditional, like extremely opaque Russian nesting dolls of these compartmented access programs that may be being used as cover for these illegal activities. And then they're coming out through another shell of whistleblower protection. And so if you're trying to like understand, okay, like how did this come out? Well, it kind of came out through this, you know, there's this sort of like opaque structure inside these classified programs. And it's coming out through, you know, part of that opaque structure that is now funneled through this sort of legal pipeline of intelligence inspector general complaints. So if you're evaluating this as like just a bystander, right, it's very hard because all the relevant facts at issue are classified, right? And so you're having to weigh, you know, essentially individual credibility. You're having to weigh, you know, his claims, which to right now at this point are entirely like first order hearsay. So all that he's said is what he's been told from other individuals that he, you know, basically interviewed and documents that he was provided in the course of him performing his official duties. And so he's making these claims. You're sort of putting as much evidence on his claims to the extent that you either think the individuals that he's talking to either actually exist and all the other sort of secondary corroboration for those existence of those other individuals, whether those individuals are telling him the truth and whether those materials that are being provided to him that he alleges exist are factual materials and aren't being sort of manipulated. So you have to kind of, you know, then branch out your credences, right? Like, do I trust him? Do I think he's telling the truth? Probably yes, right? If you think that he is who he says he is, but are the claims that he's making actually true? Because he could believe them to be true and they could actually not be true. He could be being fed false information. And that's, I think, where we're in kind of this limbo land, right? And so I'm not recommending anyone, you know, generate a set of final credences for those claims. But I think where we are, if you look at the issue seriously, is it certainly warrants investigation by multiple bodies, right? So it certainly seems like we're in a position that requires investigation because it's either that there's some group of people inside the government that seriously believe this stuff and are, you know, either being misled by their colleagues to believe it. And these are people in positions of major national security responsibility. David Grush was responsible for the production and delivery of the presidential daily brief, which is the most classified sensitive document in the U.S. government. And he was, you know, had apparently in terms of like access to the SAPs and CAPs had, you know, among the most expansive access as you can get in the U.S. government. So someone like him, is either being manipulated or himself is manipulating, that needs investigation. Or this is true, in which case it is explosive and, you know, we obviously need to get to the bottom of it. So I think, like, wherever you end up, you don't necessarily have to come to some final set of, you know, beliefs about the underlying claims. You just have to, you know, generate enough reason to believe there's something fishy going on to say we need to have serious investigation by bodies that at least, you know, who are somewhat independent from the actors being charged with malfeasance, right? So in this case, you wouldn't necessarily trust the Defense Department or the intelligence community to lead this investigation. You'd want, you know, outside groups like the Senate, the DOJ, inspector generals to do these investigations. That's kind of where I'm at right now.
Mm-hmm. And is there a precedent in terms of like previous events with whistleblowers and these SAPs and CAPS programs? Like, is there a way in which we can understand historically how these types of interactions have played out? And I'm kind of thinking, you know, maybe this could inform our understanding of probabilities as to whether or not himself is being manipulated or he himself is manipulating. Like, has there been, I guess, joint cooperation between whistleblowers and those things on which they are whistleblowing that you're aware of? And I'm not sure if that is the case, but would be curious if there's, like, you know, historical precedent for how these types of interactions have played out. You know, if there's, I mean, there's in many ways you could explain their modes of cooperation, but historically, is there like anything that could kind of shed a light on how these processes have played out in the past that you believe has credence?
It's a good point. I mean, we certainly have seen a number of whistleblowers, you know, famously leak information, right? Snowden, Reality Winner. If you go back in time, you've got Daniel Ellsberg. In those cases, it was the sort of the action was to sort of take some actual documents, bring them to journalists. The journalists, you know, try to vet them and then publish them. In this case, he hasn't done that. So he hasn't been a whistleblower, I would say, in that traditional case where he's coming out and saying, you know, like, I'm willing to put myself in legal jeopardy by making these claims. He's made these claims, you know, formally through kind of the whistleblower channels inside the government. And so those whistleblower channels are used quite a lot inside the normal intelligence community and Defense Department. Typically, though, they don't get much play or publicity because they're kind of not about, you know, interesting things. They're like, oh, like, I saw someone steal money, or I saw like bad things happen in Iraq, and I'm gonna like whistleblow. So like, we've had those whistleblower channels used a lot on a subject like this. I don't think so, but I think, you know, it does pose, I think, a potentially unique challenge, given the nature of the allegation is that, you know, these programs are so like deeply nested inside the sort of dark structure of classified protected programs, that imposes like a major constraint on the ability of investigators to kind of run it to ground, because you have to have the sufficient clearance to even know. So some of the programs that he's alleging are being used as like a cover for these illegal UAP programs are themselves extremely sensitive. And so doing the investigation, you know, into the sort of secret parts or the illegal parts of these secret programs, it would be something that the US government would be like very, very squirrely about, right? They would not want just like open testimony, taking witnesses, talking about the secret thing we're doing against the Chinese, right? Like, they would not want that secret, legitimate, you know, program to be burned in the process of trying to go after potentially these illegitimate activities that are being used, you know, as a cover. And so that is where we are now, right? What you're seeing, in a sense, the legislative response to this, right? I think just today there was an article about how, you know, there are amendments being passed to like two major kind of pieces of legislation. One is the National Defense Authorization Act that basically, you know, sets policy requirements for the Department of Defense. And the other is the Intelligence Authorization Act, which sets similar policy requirements for the intelligence community, which includes some sort of military components like the National Security Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, et cetera. And in those, you know, markups, I think today, actually, the NDAA is being marked up. And then I think last week, the IAA was officially reported out from the subcommittee. They both are apparently going to have additional UAP-related provisions specifically targeting, quote unquote, like rogue SAPs. So Senator Gillibrand, who's probably one of the more, say, vocal and focused members of the Senate on this issue, although she's not alone. There's many other members of Senate that are also perturbed by this, apparently. They are kind of reacting to what they're hearing. And I think a lot of it is, you know, happening behind the scenes, and then it sort of comes out in these sort of legislative maneuvers that, you know, she's going to be putting in place. And I think this is actually going to very likely happen, is that in the next package of NDAA and IAA provisions, there's going to be specific requirements, basically say, you know, if there's any money being spent on special access programs that haven't been reported to the Gang of Eight, to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, you know, like that's against the law. And so like they're, and this follows in a trend, because if you like the last two National Defense Authorization Acts, both had increasingly expansive and stringent provisions specifically put in on UAPs. Like this didn't come out of nowhere. Like there's a whole kind of apparatus that's being sort of slowly constructed to bring more congressional attention and scrutiny on these programs that are alleged to exist inside the government. And you're seeing kind of those things play out, kind of they eventually sort of break through the surface. And so this is kind of where we are now, right? Is that, you know, David Grush is like the most, I'd say, like attention grabbing aspect of this topic. But like behind that, there's a whole machinery of kind of legislative maneuvers and kind of behind the scenes jockeying between people that, you know, want this to come out and folks that don't want to come out. And so that's kind of where we are.
Yeah. And in terms of wrangling in these illegal activities, is this like method of doing so effective? And like, I believe, you know, there were reports of the Pentagon losing, I think like trillions of dollars in a, you know, misaccounting or accounting mistakes. And recently, I think there was, you know, a recently announced accounting mistake of like $6 billion that was sent to Ukraine that was not properly accounted for. And so like, are you hopeful or optimistic about the ability of this type of wrangling to be successful? And like, are there failure modes for this type of intervention?
That is an excellent question, because I think you could see, this could be a litmus test for how effective our institutions are at this moment. Because if the allegations are true, then there's been, you know, a systematic cover-up, deception, and malfeasance, you know, taking place over decades, which would severely undermine public trust in the government, potentially, right? And so the ability of the government, at least the democratic structures we have, to, you know, impose transparency on those activities and to, you know, right those wrongs would be a good test of democracy. So I think that's what we're going to see. And I think one way of reading things like Russia's interview is as a kind of shot across the bow. And so he did it in a very calibrated manner where he didn't, you know, explicitly leak information that was classified. He sort of went through the proper channels, and he was among the first to do so. I mean, the actual whistleblower protections for this issue weren't written into law and passed until December of 2022. He had submitted his complaints well before then. So he was using kind of the existing whistleblower protections, but the law now exists for others to come forward. And he's sort of thrown down the gauntlet, it seems, to the existing structure inside the Pentagon and the IC to say, listen, like, I'm letting you know that there's other people that I'm aware of that have, you know, firsthand information that could come out in one of two ways. It could come out through like the official process that Congress has set up so that there is transparency, accountability, and reporting to the representatives of the public on activities that have alleged to have been conducted in secret and away from public, from democratic oversight for decades. And we're going to set these mechanisms up, and we expect them to be functioning, to allow individuals to go through the proper processes internally to protect this information while making it available to representatives of the people. But if there seems to be stonewalling or stalling or delay or intimidation or reprisal, I think the subtext of Grush's interview is that, you know, there are people potentially prepared to come out anyways and make this public regardless. And so that is one way of that I might read where we are now, is that Grush is the public face for potentially others that are, you know, kind of putting down a challenge to the existing structures of accountability to say, okay, if these work, I'm willing to go through them and play this, you know, the right way. But as kind of like, you know, a little bit of a game of leverage, right? Like if you don't let that play out, like people might just spill things in a much more, say, uncontrollable and explosive fashion. I think that was the lesson I took from David Grush, is like, everyone's like, oh crap, like, what did he say? Like, because he sort of dialed it up to 11, right? He didn't just come out and say, oh yeah, the government thinks the UAPs are real non-human technology, and we've been studying, you know, sensor data for a while. He went to like, we have multiple crashes. We have bodies of non-human, you know, intelligences. We have potentially conducted, you know, illegal operations and murdered people. Like he went basically and said all of like the UFO conspiracy lore. He kind of like implicitly and somewhat explicitly validated it, right? At least that's his personal testimony. So he kind of threw the gauntlet down. And, you know, I think the existing structure is still trying to digest that, right? I think the folks in the Senate, if you look at some of the reporting of their comments over the past, you know, 2 weeks, you know, there's been, you know, a few on the record statements by members of the Senate and some members of the House. And generally speaking, people are not dismissing him or attacking him, because everyone knows that he has, you know, immense professional bona fides, but they don't really want to, you know, grant too much credence to the explicit claims, because they're like prima facie absurd. And these are members of our, you know, most august body, right? The Senate. And so they're going to, you know, start to grapple with the idea of, you know, some like secret multi-decade government program to reverse engineer, essentially, like, you know, Roswell was real. All those, all the pop culture narratives we have about this topic are essentially just refractions of the truth. Like, if that was the case, oh man, like, you would not want to be a member of the Senate right now, because then you're like, oh crap, I have to run for re-election. I have to, like, I've got to own the obligation to enforce transparency on this topic. Like, it's a tall order. So I think they're, you know, they always want to take things slower. They always want to have a more deliberative pace. They want to have like a step function to, you know, move this along. But, you know, sometimes you just can't control it. And I think that's where we are now, is this tension between folks on the inside, like Rush, who are like, there's something really, you know, stinky going on here, and it needs to, you know, be brought out into the light, and others that maybe want to slow things down. And so that's, I think, just a lesson of like institutional accountability, right? And it's, you know, that's actually my biggest takeaway from this whole thing, is as a lesson about, you know, not just about like the sensational claims at issue, but just, okay, like, in general, human institutions tend to reinforce themselves over time. They tend to construct moats and justifications for their own power expanding over time. Yeah. They tend to try to shake off and mitigate the ability of third party groups to constrain or corral them. And, you know, the job of functioning democracies is always a tension between democracy and intelligence services. This actually goes back, you know, to the beginning of the Republic, is like, is having secret intelligence services compatible with democracy, right? It's always like an inherent tension, because you need to have intelligence and military doing secret things, you know, in a competitive world. But those institutions over time can abuse, you know, that special status that's afforded them by democratic society to do things in secret to protect the society from their adversaries. And it's the job of, you know, we have certain institutions in the Senate particularly that are sort of the thin line holding those institutions to account. And so I think that's what we're going to see in this particular case, is how much, you know, how good is that? How good is that structure? You know, that's the challenge that's laid before the Senate right now.
Yeah. And when you were describing that, I think something that really caught my attention, you're describing Grusher's relationship with these clandestine programs and his, you know, turning the knob up to 11 and kind of firing a shot across the bow of being like, hey, like, you know, there's more here, tread carefully, I guess, kind of showing them a little bit of the cards that he may have. And in the context of, you know, the potential impacts of this, you know, high level technology, you know, there is also the geopolitical and, you know, international conflict component of it. And I believe I've seen you on Twitter kind of, you know, raise the idea that, you know, one benefit of kind of letting this dirty laundry out into the air a little bit is to say, hey, to our adversaries, this is something that we have obtained and have some dominion over, you know, be careful, sort of. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, how do you assess how likely that is the case, that that's what this signaling is? And then I'd love to, you know, after we address that, like, just unpack what the implications, assuming that this technology does exist, what would the implications be for institutions and our international relations aspects of our government and society.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm really glad you go in this direction, because that's the part that to me is, you know, there's lots of interesting aspects about this topic, but I think this is one that's maybe underexplored. And that is, it is alleged in the Grush reporting, the Leslie Keene, Ralph Blumenthal story, and then some other related reporting from Ross Coulthart, is that this is a secret Cold War. That, you know, if you grant the stipulation that these are real objects that we've apparently been trying to retrieve, well, you know, I'm sure other adversaries would have been trying to do the same thing, because trying to understand how this advanced technology functions and be able to apply that for either military intelligence or just general economic purposes would give you a strategic geopolitical advantage. And so it makes perfect sense that you would treat this as a very, you know, secret thing if it was true. In fact, you would probably treat it as among the most secret thing, because the lesson of World War II was that the nation that can leverage advanced physics and can convert that, you know, knowledge of the most advanced physics into strategic technology wins world wars. And I don't think the governments of the world forgot that lesson. And so, and that's a part of the reported allegations. In fact, some of the on the record kind of corroboration in the original debrief article came from, you know, a man who was going by a pseudonym, but it's sort of his legend name at NASIC, which is the National Air Intelligence Space Center, basically at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is, you know, in the UFO lore is where like the Roswell crash went, et cetera. It's where we have kind of the foreign technology division, where we do all of our foreign technology, where we like reverse engineering stuff, you know, Space Force. We do a lot of stuff at, you know, at Wright-Patt and NASIC. This has been a secret Cold War. And so like that apparently Russia has at least one, maybe multiple crafts. Ross Coulthart has made statements in from apparently his sources that have told him that Russia has like reverse engineering program, you know, in the Ural Mountains, put as much weight on that as you see fit. And that, you know, apparently now China's trying to get in the game and is trying to, you know, catch up to where the great superpowers are. So it's like, if you grant the assumption this is all true, then like, you know, that's what you would expect. You would expect there to be kind of a secret Cold War going on over this technology, and you would expect it to be treated with the highest security precautions, so just like we did for the Manhattan Project, but probably even more so, because we found out after the war that the Manhattan Project had been famously penetrated by the Soviet intelligence services. And so I'm sure we learned how to try to keep this as secret as possible because of its strategic implications. So that's like, this thing doesn't just stay in like the interesting sort of sci-fi, oh, interesting alien box. It really spills out very quickly, if it's true, into the geopolitical arena. Because if it's true, then of course, you know, it changes how you think about the strategic calculations taking place between great powers. And that really hinges, though, I think on like, you know, one critical question, right? So you're starting at just to step back to our kind of our Bayesian conversation, is like, you start at the base of the Bayesian tree on this question of like, are UAPs represent real non-human technology and a physical presence? Kind of like, yes or no. It's like, okay, you know, you're not going to be binary 100%, you know, yes or no, but you're going to be, then that decides how you branch in all the different directions. Once you go into the yes branch, then you have, okay, if they're real and they're physically here, you know, are any human institutions in physical possession of materials or full versions of those vehicles? Like, yes or no, right? Are those vehicles, you know, and then like another relevant branch would be, has any of those institutions successfully, you know, reverse engineered relevant technology from those retrieved materials or vehicles, yes or no? And so I think one of the critical strategic questions is on the farther end of that branch of the tree, which is, have anyone been successful at converting any of these things into useful technology? Right? And this is where we're truly in the dark, right? Like no one, as far as I can tell, nothing that Grush has said, nothing that anyone has sort of leaked or, you know, come forward as like any sort of first or secondhand hearsay witness, it says anything about like, you know, have we reverse engineered it? Like some people, that's been like part of the sort of the UFO lore, is that yes, like we secretly, you know, created these, you know, really advanced vehicles, you know, that can do all sorts of crazy things, maybe not as crazy as what the originals can do, but we have like quote unquote alien reproduction vehicles. So like my credences start to cascade from like the base of the tree, where they're relatively high. By the time we get to the claim, have we like reverse engineered our own versions of them? It's pretty low. But that's where the strategic implications become most acute, because to your point about the
you know, constructing a scenario where why we would want to, say, leak this story, right? Like one plausible story you could tell in that kind of branch of like the this is all for geopolitical signaling tree, like why now, is we're worried about the conventional overmatch that China has in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait, that, you know, we are going to be lagging in terms of our naval production, our missile production, armament production, and our general like political unity to be able to counter or even overcome the PLA in an armed conflict over Taiwan. And so if you had an ace in the hole, you know, strategic capability that maybe you engineered as a result of having access to non-human technology, you would, you know, only bring that technology out of the box. You would only bring it out of the bunker or the hangar, wherever it's sitting, in cases where it's strategically existential, right? You would only bring it out in the cases where the US's world position was on the line. And so you would in that scenario, you would only expect, you know, but again, like a capability is only as good as the adversary knows it exists in terms of its deterrence value, right? Like a secret capability has no deterrent value. So you need to let the adversary know that the capability exists without giving too much away about one, how you got it, and two, how it actually works, so it can be defeated or the adversary can generate their own version. And so that is like, that is one story you could tell, is like, we're coming up on what's, you know, generally perceived to be kind of the Davidson window, or kind of the maximum danger zone in terms of US-China military kind of parity. And it comes down to President Xi's, you know, personal predilections of risk-taking and the strategic balance of power to make a move maybe in the next 3 to 5 years on Taiwan if he chooses. And so, you know, maybe we get to the 2030s and we will have potentially mitigated some of the immediate military sort of disequilibrium that exists down there. But maybe between now and the end of the decade is the most kind of acute period of strategic instability. And if that's the case, then this would explain why, if we did have an advanced capability that we would only use in those very in that moment of strategic risk, we would start to leak it. We would start to, you know, become more public about it, right? And then maybe that's an explanation for, well, if we are eventually going to have to use a capability like this, we have to explain how it works and how we got it, et cetera. Now that to me is, I'm like, I'm pretty far down just telling a story. I don't actually have like a very high credence in that particular scenario, but I think it's something you have to like explore. Like I just sort of like to explore all these different branches of the tree. And I think that's an interesting one to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I'm going to kind of borrow a page from the book of Alan Farrington when he talks about Bitcoin, where he says, you know, if a decentralized money was monetizing from zero, what would that look like? And he, you know, his kind of claim is that it would look exactly as it does today in terms of Bitcoin's monetization and the game theory as it plays out. And I guess I'd like to pose a similar question to you, where, you know, if, you know, these craft do exist, if this advanced technology does indeed exist and is in somebody's grasp, what would it look like? And I know you've spoken to Eric Weinstein before, talking about kind of the dead end of string theory. You know, he has thoughts on kind of the, I guess, capture of physics as an institution. And I mean, to my, you know, this is a highly speculative on my end, but I just kind of want to play it out. Is like, does that square at all with the idea that if we want to maintain control over this technology, and we don't want somebody else to reverse engineer or engineer from the ground up similar capabilities, what would it look like? And, you know, I would posit that it might look like something along the lines of keeping a control over this type of information. And then, you know, you would even want to kind of mislead those competing against you in creating that technology, lead them astray. And so that's a whole can of worms. But I would be curious, yeah, you know, what your thoughts are both on that, and then also on what this physics, I mean, this is also completely unfair, but like what those physics might be. And like, obviously, you know, it would clash with our understanding of what we're capable of today, but what might it suggest about what is possible, or what it says about the current state of physics as we know it today?
Yeah, and this is where I think sometimes the topic about UAPs is, you know, it gets sensationalized, but for me, it's very directly related to, you know, what are very serious conversations in physics about like what are the rules of reality, right? Like human civilization advances through the ability of humanity to convert knowledge about physics, the knowledge about like the degrees of freedom that exist in our physical world, to useful technology that we can use to move matter and energy around to suit our purposes. Like that's how, You know, that's like the story of, you know, humankind, and especially the story of Industrial Revolution, and certainly the story of the past 100 years, where as we unlocked theories of physics, you know, very quickly we converted that understanding into useful technology, right? From electromagnetism, you know, with Maxwell's equations, right? We figured out, okay, you can spin magnets in coil and you can generate electricity, and boom, you get like very useful things for civilization. And in the 20s and 30s, we you know, went through a similar kind of revolution, and we sort of unlocked quantum mechanics and general relativity, those general theories. And in particular, you know, with quantum mechanics and peering into the atom, we got nuclear physics, and we sort of put that, as well as our burgeoning understanding of sort of the computational nature of reality and sort of theories of computation together. And we got the nuclear bomb, we got the integrated circuit, and we got sort of modern technological civilization. And so, like, the lesson that we should draw is that, you know, very quickly you can, and I think, you know, Eric Weinstein sort of makes this, like, very quickly you can convert fundamental discoveries into strategic, you know, civilizational changing technologies that are not linear, right? These are sort of step function changes, right? Before nuclear weapons existed, you had a certain way of, you had a certain structure of global politics, of warfare. And now, and then after you had nuclear weapons, it entirely changed. You had, you know, potentially city destroying, country destroying, world destroying capabilities in the hands of you know, essentially single individuals had the power to destroy the world, which had never existed before. And I think we kind of forget that. We've kind of forgotten that lesson of the direct kind of time scale that historically exists between fundamental physics breakthroughs and strategic civilization changing technology, because we just haven't seen it, right? Because physics has stalled. We haven't really had the same pace of breakthroughs in fundamental physics that have been able to be converted into useful technology, you know, really in decades, right? The closest that maybe we're getting recently might be quantum computing, but again, that's very speculative. And it's hard to say if that would even be at the scale of, say, like electromagnetism or quantum mechanics. It's really just kind of like a technical kind of elaboration of our known physics already. So that's like where I think UAPs point you, is like, okay, well, if UAPs exist as real non-human technology, they kind of represent a proof of concept that someone or something figured out additional rules of physics that we haven't figured out. And so by studying how they operate could give you, like, could allow you to kind of like jump to that level of understanding. You wouldn't have to necessarily wait hundreds of years to build ever larger particle accelerators and for some new Einstein to come out of the woodwork and figure something out, right? You could just say, oh, well, someone already figured it out, right? It'd be like giving an iPhone and being like, okay, well, how, on what physical principles does an iPhone have to work? And you could maybe work your way eventually down to figuring out, oh, they rely on transistors. The transistors rely on, you know, these things like voltage gates. So that requires understanding of, you know, quantum mechanics. And this is how the theory of computation works. Like, maybe eventually you could work yourself down there, right? If you had enough time. And I think that's maybe the position we're in, is like, you know, if these UAPs exist, it's like saying an iPhone back to like ancient Greece. It's like, okay, it's a glowing rock, right? What are you going to do with it, right? Primitive societies put the glowing rock on a pedestal and they worship as some gift from the god. Modern technological societies that have enough knowledge of space and physics, it could say, oh, maybe this is some other civilization to figure something out. We should study it secretly and see if we can gain a strategic advantage. Now, Weinstein tells a slightly conspiratorial story that I don't know, you know, whether I followed exactly, because physics is very hard. So you could explain the sort of stalling of physics in the early 70s and the kind of the intellectual cul-de-sac that, you know, string theory has turned out to be. I mean, string theories generate a lot of useful mathematical insights and dualities that are certainly very interesting, but as a like falsifiable theory of physics, I think it's basically failed. And that traces basically back to the 70s, where before that, though, we were making pretty rapid progress. You know, post-war, you know, the scientific establishment was sort of riding on the coattails of a massively expanding and invigorated bureaucratic state, you know, in the West that had won World War II. And so there was a tight synergy between the institutions of science and the institutions of kind of the state security apparatus, is basically being the kind of conjoined twins that won World War II, you know, bringing all the best scientists together into a institutional, military-controlled bureaucracy is what won World War II. It created the bomb, and then it created the, you know, the Enigma, you know, decoding machine with Turing. You know, there's a whole, you know, legacy of bringing science under the fold of kind of the military industrial complex. And then it slowly started to peel itself out in the 50s in the creation of the National Science Foundation and, you know, separate academic funding. But, you know, like, if you're a conspiracy theory, you know, if you're trying to tell a more maybe nefarious narrative, right, that's in keeping with the kind of the UAP narrative. I mean, I think Eric has made some allusions to this in some of his statements, is that, You know, there was like serious gravity research being conducted at the leading institutions, you know, immediately post-war, like into the 50s. Like it was a major topic of research in terms of unpacking general relativity in parallel with what was an emerging strain of physics research and particle physics and the construction of ever larger particle accelerators and the sort of elaboration of what became the standard model of particle physics that dealt with all the forces besides gravity. And that sort of branch of physics was very successful and sort of came to dominate sort of most of what, you know, was academic institutional physics from the 50s, you know, into the 70s was building ever larger colliders, you know, the particle zoo being created and, you know, discovering and confirming, you know, every aspect of the sort of standard model of particle physics. Meanwhile, the branch that sort of was started and, you know, with general relativity that was being elaborated apparently in the 50s kind of died out. It just stalled and kind of disappeared from mainstream physics. You know, there's one story there that's just, it was a dead end. No one had any good ideas. And meanwhile, this other branch of physics was constantly generating new discoveries and papers and all the grad students went over there. That's where all the funding was. And so that's what dominated. Now, like there's a, if your mind is attuned to the conspiratorial, well, maybe there's a story that you could tell that says, actually, at the same time that was happening, there was a secret group that had gotten possession of these vehicles that were obviously, you know, representative of some knowledge of physics that we don't have that had to do with like, that had to have some understanding of gravity that we don't have, right? Because they effectively operate without inertia, right? Doing 90 degree turns at high speeds, transmedium travel, et cetera. Like this is sort of, there's something about gravity that these objects are manipulating. And so maybe what you would do then is you would take all the interesting science research about fundamental physics, you know, research that's happening on gravity, and you would tuck it away. You would put it on behind the curtain, and you would let the particle physics stuff kind of continue to play out, and then it sort of stalled. Now I don't know. Like, I did philosophy of science as well as undergrad. It's hard to like the government is good at protecting technology. It's very good at protecting, you know, like specific pieces of intelligence. It's kind of hard to keep ideas in the box, like an idea, an equation, especially over decades. It's hard if someone had like figured out some super advanced theory of physics that was truly what we're all waiting for. It's hard to think that could just stay secret for decades. Like an actual piece of craft, yeah, you could just not let people see it or get access to it. But like an idea, like a framework, a theoretical model, that's harder for me to think about the government keeping entirely secret and like killing public physics for decades intentionally. So this leads me to believe that generally speaking, you know, it wasn't all like a conspiracy to kind of kill anti-gravity and that sort of research. I don't know. It could be true. I'm basically in the camp that if I ascribe relatively high credence to these objects being real, I think we're more likely to be in the position of like ancient Greece, which is, you know, with an iPhone, which is like, we don't really know where to start. Like we have bare hints of where to go. But the idea that we were able to kind of quickly figure out new physics, how they made it, what principles that they built them on, and then engineer a functioning vehicle off of that knowledge and keep all that secret. I don't know. I need to be convinced. I'm not quite there yet. So yeah, so that's kind of where I am on that whole question. So, but I guess my last point would be, because there's ambiguity in that question, right? There is still strategic deterrence value in having your adversary not know how far you've got. And I think Grush pointed at this, right? Like he sees that he's a patriotic American. He doesn't want to give away, you know, actual secrets that would undermine U.S. national security and to the advantage of our adversaries. But he believes that there's, you know, there was wrongdoing here and there's like an inherent obligation of transparency that needs to be met on behalf of the American public. But he's also pointing to the fact that there is a strategic game of kind of deterrent communications that's always happening in this subject, right? Because, you know, say we've made zero progress, right, in decades on this technology, right? You wouldn't want their adversaries to know that, right? And so, you know, that makes the strategic calculations about what parts of this topic you let be disclosed. There's a, you know, very major, you know, counterintelligence issue of what adversaries could figure out from pieces of information that get confirmed. So if you're sitting, you know, in the program or adjacent to the program, there's a reason why they spend so much more on security than on actual R&D for these things, allegedly. And that's generally the practice for, you know, you know, all special access programs. They're just very expensive to keep secret. You know, generally speaking, the counterintelligence kind of 101 is just don't let anything out, right? Because it's very, you don't know what piece of information can be put together by adversaries to construct kind of the puzzle and then figure out, you know, what capabilities you actually have or don't have. And so if you're actually using this as a, you know, as a means, or at least incidentally as a means of strategic deterrence, or you potentially want to use it as that in the future, you wouldn't want to give any information away that would undermine the potential, you know, deterrence value of at least the ambiguity involved in this topic. So that is where this gets very tricky. And that's also where, you know, there is, I believe, like, I think a true, like, tension in mind. So if I stipulate Grush's claims to be true, I still think there are, you know, honest national security imperatives and considerations that would need to be weighed, right? Because if they are true, and, you know, our adversaries are also in a race for this technology, it is a strategic game about whether you can, you know, move along a direction of transparency, which I think is definitely an obligation, but without giving away too much information about, say, like US's capabilities in this regard, right? This is a major challenge. And actually, like, the last point I would make on that sort of larger question is we're seeing a version of this play out with, you know, the emerging kind of jockeying and sort of policy discourse around AI, right? It's like, if you think about it, it's like this, there's a, and it's also like one sort of sociological footnote is like, it's apparently a safe topic of discourse among like the elites in our society and even now policymakers to think about the prospect of AI, you know, becoming super intelligent and posing existential risks to humanity, which was a complete sci-fi fringe topic, you know, 5-10 years ago. I actually wrote an entire novel about that sort of very plot of, you know, an incubated, a program, you know, secret government program looking at quantum computing and AI that, you know, creates this super intelligence that escapes out of the box, and China and Russia are all trying to, you know, jockey for the same information. This was like a, you know, a topic of fringe discourse, right? To think about super intelligent AI take over the world, right? There's a certain subculture in San Francisco and philosophers that were thinking about it, writing books about it, et cetera. But only like in the past 6 months has it become kind of safe for kind of quote normies and the New York Times op-ed page to like, you know, weigh in on this, right? And I think the topic of UAPs hasn't quite penetrated that Overton, you know, barrier, though it could be slowly, might happen more quickly over the course of the summer, depending on, you know, what happens next. But there's a similar strategic game being played out at this geopolitical level when it comes to sort of AI regulation. If the premise is, you know, there's a global coordination problem, a collective action problem associated with this emerging technology, you know, if you ascribe to sort of AI doom or some version of that, then you need to have some global regime put in place that tightly regulates essentially research on this strategic technology. And this is why Sam Altman was in Beijing and flying in the Middle East and doing these summits. And, you know, there's a certain strain of thinking, especially in the effective altruist community, that says we need to have kind of, you know, a global human view towards the existential risk posed by these sorts of technologies. And so, you know, like geopolitical barriers be damned, like this is for the greater good of humanity's future cosmic destiny, et cetera. Meanwhile, like, if you stipulate that Grush's claims are true, there actually has been a secret arms race for decades among the world's great powers to, you know, try to acquire and reverse engineer non-human technology that would give them a strategic advantage. And that, you know, if the lesson of the nuclear weapon is at all close analogy to this case, you know, there potentially is, you know, existential implications for maybe the mistaken or malevolent deployment of that technology, right? Like, whatever power source or energy source this knowledge of physics, if it's true, represents, could be extremely good for humanity, right? Like, we may be able to do what these, you know, Tic Tacs can do, which would be quite remarkable for, you know, humankind's aspirations on a galactic scale. On the other hand, you know, if it turns out to be giving, you know, chimpanzee a grenade and we pull the pin on ourselves, right, it would not be so good. And so you could imagine if you're sitting in some deep dark bunker somewhere and you're managing this program and you don't really know exactly how this stuff works, you know, you would worry about this spilling out and giving the grenade to the chimpanzees. And so you just say, keep it in the box every 10 years or so, get some best scientists in there, maybe try to figure out incrementally new knowledge of, say, material science, et cetera. And if we don't have anything, then we just keep it on ice until our science advances. So that could be where we are, right? Is there's multiple levels of consideration and calculation going on. not only at the level of like, you know, one, like personal exposure, right? If these individuals are conducting activities as Grush alleges, you know, they potentially violated multiple laws, right? They may have put themselves at extreme personal legal liability in jeopardy. So they may have a personal interest in keeping the secret, but that may be conflated also with, you know, potentially legitimate reasons to keep some aspects of this stuff secret. One, for the purposes of maintaining geopolitical strategic advantage over our U.S. you know, adversaries, and not giving away things or revealing aspects of our capability one way or the other. And it could also be not wanting to spring technology on humanity that we're not ready for, right? You know, people make that argument about nuclear weapons, right? There's a whole Christopher Nolan movie just about this subject of, okay, like, did we unleash something on ourselves that we're not prepared for? Could this be could humankind's curiosity be the author of its own doom? And, you know, that may weigh also in these conversations. So I don't go into this UAP subject with, like, you know, with sort of frivolity and kind of like sci-fi goofiness. I see it as a topic of, if it's true, of like the highest strategic and existential import. And I think you saw something like that happen with the AI conversation. It still is kind of in this sort of penumbra of, okay, you know, it's kind of weird that these people think that it's going to turn us all into paperclips, or at least molecular sized paperclip looking objects. But there's enough serious people from Google. And so we operate on kind of a status signaling, like our societies operate on a mechanism where we look to our existing elites and scientists and folks in certain positions of status to kind of affirm and validate categories of belief before they can become, you know, acceptable objects of policy discourse in mainstream media and, you know, forums and summits in major cities. And that's the sort of transition that AI has gone through in the past, I'd say, 12 months. And you can imagine, you know, at least that might be a useful template to think about if you're postulating this subject going through a similar transition. That's maybe one template to think about. So that was a lot. I was just sort of rambling for a while.
No, that was great, right?
oh, physics. You want me to talk about physics?
Yeah, well, right? I have a great segue there. And I know you said you wanted to kind of stay on the rails in this conversation, but I just can't help myself but pull you off a little bit. And something that Grush said is, you know, he was kind of speculating as to how these UAPs would be propelling themselves. And his kind of take was, you know, maybe they're utilizing higher dimensions and they're able to interface with our lower dimensional contextualization of reality in some way. And I think he's invoking quantum physics or maybe like the Everettian interpretation of many worlds, and somehow they're able to, you know, jump across branches. And I mean, that's just kind of me, you know, painting on top of the small snippet he said. But do you lend any credence to his interpretation of that potential avenue for how this technology functions? And again, being very unfair, but I would be curious, you know, your thoughts on his interpretation.
Yes. So I guess the way I would start, just to kind of zoom out to this whole conversation, is I would analogize it to like we're in a forest clearing, and we can see pretty well, you know, the contours of the terrain in the clearing, and, you know, immediately into the adjacent trees in the forest. And so like the sort of, that's like our epistemic territory, right? Like, so the clearing represents the facts we already covered in the early part of this conversation about, you know, the overt maneuvers, you know, by the Congress to pass laws, the stand up of these official organizations, the issuance of these reports, the on the record statements by senior government officials, other folks, et cetera. That's like in the clearing. We sort of moved a bit into the, you know, the edge of the forest when we're thinking about Grush's claims in particular. He's kind of like the bridge between the clearing and into the dark forest. He's making statements from a position of high professional credibility, but that sort of forces us to take these deep excursions into the darkness where we don't have as much, say, epistemic purchase. And that's, so this is the part of the conversation where you're really going deeper into the forest, right? There you're looking at, okay, well, if these are real objects that they represent technology that's, you know, far beyond what humanity can currently produce, well, then we have to reconcile their origin and the nature of their function, right? Those are like the two key like questions. And there's a whole dark forest of speculation in the UFO sci-fi lore about all the various permutations of that, right? Of whether it's time travel, whether they're, you know, future humans, et cetera, coming back to us and steering us towards a maybe more favorable timeline or helping us along and maybe a branching timeline from their own. That's like one category. Another category is they are civilizations that have reached a certain state of technological development on Earth well before humanity, or at least Homo sapiens sapiens, reached a similar level of capability. And maybe they just left, you know, they just like left the planet and have kept some aspects of themselves around to kind of see what happens. Maybe there was some cataclysm that wiped them out, but like some portions of their civilization was able to survive, you know, in the ocean or whatever. And they're popping up, you know, now to kind of, you know, rejoin the human family and help us along and bootstrap themselves as well. Maybe it's traditional ETs. Maybe they are actually, you know, they incubated on a star system that's like a panspermia sibling of ours, like the Robin Hanson hypothesis. And they have a rule against not being grabby, so they didn't convert us into, you know, computronium like any other grabby civilization would. And so they sent out probes, though, and a minor violation of their civilizational rule against expansion to any sibling system that, you know, they could recognize from their stellar composition in a sort of a galactic, in a ring around the Milky Way, and could send essentially AI probes with a simple sort of SOP to look for signs of advanced technology like gamma ray detection from nuclear testing to start to make themselves more overt. And they would, you know, start to increase their engagement with humanity as a way of signaling that they're here, that they obviously are more capable than us, and that we would naturally sort of, as sociological sort of status seeking animals, defer to their position on the top of the hierarchy. We would eventually adopt their rule against being grabby on pain of potentially being having that rule enforced on us. And so we just become sort of domesticated, right? That's like the grabby aliens hypothesis. It's like an extension of the ET hypothesis. Then there's like another, which is like getting to the physics question, right? So this is all me just dialing into like the physics piece of what Grush said, which is something in the domain of like transdimensional, right? Interdimensional, but which is usually a catch-all term for something that in physics is maybe not as well defined as in sort of pop culture. Because a dimension is just a degree of freedom in space, right? And so we have all sorts of physical theories going back even before string theory that postulated like a fifth dimension for like, I think it was, what's his name? I'm blanking. But there was an early theory of physics that tried to do primitive unification with general relativity and quantum mechanics, or really electromagnetism, that postulated, I think it was gravity in like a fifth dimension. And there was a whole, you know, there's a whole strand of research in physics that postulates, okay, what is the structure of the manifold on which we're modeling quantum fields? And so the traditional sort of 3+1 manifold is, you know, what we observe, but, you know, what you observe isn't necessarily what exists. And so if you're trying to come up with theories of advanced physics, you know, explore different manifold structures that have different dimensionality to see if that gives you a theory of physics that can move you along. So he said things like some 4D, 5D stuff. It sounded a little jibber jabbery to me. So I don't know, like he was, you know, if he's speaking from knowledge that relates to his official government position, or if he's speaking, you know, as someone who just is, you know, kind of a physics nerd and reads a bunch of literature and, you know, that's kind of in the water cooler conversation about this stuff. I don't know. But I think, you know, we're going to have to come at this, you know, with a lot of epistemic intellectual humility in general, right? Like, I don't know we're going to know like where this goes. I think, you know, we do have this as a potential intellectual challenge, is like, if they're real, you know, take away whatever motives they are for being here, you know, it is like, at least in a narrow way, like really good for physics, because you're like, oh, great, like we can study something, we can move our science along, like that would be something we would want to take advantage of. I also just think it might just be very weird, right? Like, we don't really understand reality. Like, like we're just still monkeys coming out of the jungle, right? Like we just discovered like basic physics, like from, you know, like 150 years ago, and we're sort of, you know, we think we're the smartest kids on the block, but, you know, like that's a little bit hubristic to think like we really understand what like root reality is like. And so I think we artificially constrain our views of what's possible if you had that sufficiently deep fundamental knowledge about reality. Like, what we think of as being impossible constraints could just be, you know, trivial, right? To an advanced technology, like just like things like, you know, intercontinental travel was, you know, physically impossible for, you know, most of humanity until, you know, we invented ships and then we invented planes and rockets. And so things, you know, the constraints on what you think is feasible quickly fall away once you get more advanced technology, which usually comes from more advanced science. So I don't know, there are lots of interesting research areas of modern front sort of theoretical physics that I think are very promising, like the one that I pay a lot of attention to, because I think it's, at least it's conceptually very elegant, is a research program coming out of Stephen Wolfram's kind of hypergraph models. I actually prefer kind of the branch of that that's being led by a gentleman named Jonathan Garrard, who's a mathematician, kind of category theorist, who's, I think, done the most to kind of formalize Stephen's ideas and to really unpack them in very rigorous ways. And I really like it. And, you know, Stephen's done a lot of like exposition of his ideas, I think, in public. Sometimes he speaks much more certainly about his theory than, you know, maybe it's warranted. But Jonathan is someone I would point people to, Jonathan Garrard. I think he's on Twitter at Get John with it, and he's written some really interesting papers in the past few years. But I think that's really where you're gonna have to look for, like, you know, substance on that. I think physics, you know, needs to contribute to the conversation of, okay, like, what could possibly explain this? But I don't think we're anywhere close, right? Like, it just might be so bizarre and so weird that, you know, I think anyone who has like a simple idea that, oh, they're just using wormholes or they're time traveling, it's like, we don't really understand what that means. Like, the concept of wormholes, the concept of time travel, these are all concepts you have to cash out in actual theories of physics, right? Because you know the concept of a wormhole exists, you know, as a mathematical object in certain models of general relativity. We know general relativity isn't the final theory of physics, right? So a wormhole exists only as a mathematical object in these theories, which we know aren't true. Well, we know our approximations of the truth. So we don't actually know if a wormhole is possible. We don't even know what a wormhole is if it was actually a real physical possibility. And so we kind of defer to these categories of explanation. Time travel is the same one, like very, very sort of favorite trope of sci-fi discourse, but time travel is, you know, it's like that you have to cash out in a theory of physics that has a solid account of time, which is a deep philosophical conundrum. Like, what is time? What's the relation between physical time, conscious time, the time that we ascribe to, you know, like the variable t in our physical theories that describe the dynamical evolution of these equations in our physics models. And so this is, yeah, like you can't, I think people want to have an easy resolution that explains this. This might be also why it's a very hard subject of conversation to have with the public, right? Like, if you're, like, I always try to put myself in the position of like radical empathy. Like, if I'm one of these big, bad, deep state, secret, you know, UFO program managers, right? And I've been, you know, the X-Files smoking man for the past decades, and they might have even murdered people. They may have done the most terrible stuff. But I'm like, okay, like, you know, I'd put it to the like the millennial upstart who's like, you've been holding on to this secret for decades. You need to let people know. And I go, okay, you go and explain interdimensional wormhole stuff to the average public, right? Like, you go have this conversation. You know, good luck, right? Like, I just don't know if it's just easier just to not talk about it because it's not something that, you know, we always have we have a hard time coming to a social consensus on just existing science, right? Like basic stuff, let alone something that's as like existentially confronting and scientifically fraught as like non-human intelligence. Like, it just is a subject that would be utterly confounding and, you know, potentially just, you know, like beyond the grasp of the vast majority, I mean, probably everyone, to really understand, which puts people in a position first of like ontological shock, right? Oh, like my mental model of reality wasn't true. But then as you try to recover from that shock, you want to construct a model that's correlated to what is now apparently true, but you're then going to be seeking explanations that account for this radically new thing you didn't have in your model of the world. The problem is we may not be able to come up with satisfactory explanations, right? Like imagine all of a sudden, like, they did land on the White House lawn, but they didn't announce themselves. They just said, yep, we can pop in and out of your existence whenever we want. You know, good luck, make of that what you will. Like, it would just be utterly confounding to us, right? Like, it would be very hard to grok as a society. And so, yeah, it's a challenge. I don't have an easy answer there.
Well, despite that, I really appreciate you helping us grok everything that's going on. And I mean, I've been absolutely fascinated by this conversation and appreciate you being so generous with your time. And on that note, I guess I've pinned up in the nest, but I encourage everyone to check out Matt's book, Expectation Value. I believe it's pinned last in the nest up there. But with that, Matt, is there anything you want to leave our audience with, pointing them to any work you're doing? Or I guess if you also have any thoughts on, you know, good sources for trying to understand exactly what's going on. I mean, people could turn towards folks like Joe Rogan, for example, or you could go through government documents and try to piece it together yourself. So, like, I guess I'd also ask, you know, how can people that are interested begin to unpack this for themselves?
Yes, and that's a tricky subject because, you know, maybe folks in this room they're Bitcoiners. Like, there's a whole separate, like, there's a similar sociology in the UFO world as Bitcoin, I think, in a lot of other kind of subcultures that incubate on social media, where this kind of there's a canonical dogma, there's a canonical, you know, kind of set of in-group lore and references and jargon and sources that are very hard to kind of, you know, get into and grok, you know, as like an outsider to that in-group or that particular kind of epistemic community. They also share similar kind of in religious terms as like an eschatology, right? Like in Bitcoin, it's hyper-Bitcoinization. In UFO kind of community, it's a disclosure, right? Sort of the grand denouement that this community is desiring. And so that can generate a whole bunch of pathologies, right? Where people, it's not, you know, you're lots of maybe bad thinking and potentially, you know, maybe unhealthy modes of thinking, right? Where people become so obsessed with a certain vision of what they think is true. They can be factionalized. And they become very emotionally charged, right? These subjects are very weighty subjects. And so people become very, you know, can generate a lot of tension and sort of in-group fracturing. So that makes finding like good sources very tough, because this isn't right now really a very, say, academically or institutionally validated sort of a subject of discourse and investigation. And so you can't use the traditional kind of signals of credibility, like, oh, it was a report from Harvard, so it's okay. But there, I think, are a few places that I would start, right? So one gentleman who I really appreciate his work, I've been following him since he, you know, started getting to this topic, is a journalist named Ross Coulthart. His book, In Plain Sight, which is a serious, you know, investigative journalist kind of perspective on, you know, looking at the subject, that was, I think, you know, like in terms of like a UFO book, is probably the best like level-headed, serious look at this. And he's, as a result of being a serious journalist who's taken this seriously and, you know, approached it with the right attitude and practices and protected sources, he's developed like really good insights. I think probably some of the best sources in this subject. So I take what he says, you know, I don't take anything just like 100%, but I take his statements as, you know, among the more weighty. I think the in terms of a news outlet, like The Debrief and the journalists that reported that like the Grush story, Leslie Keen and Ross Blumenthal, those are stand-up journalists who check their sources. You know, I think you can go down and like, you know, like I have a list, it's a public list of UAP, you know, Twitter accounts. You know, them being on that list is not an endorsement by me at all. It's just me constructing as a wide variance, because in the subject, right, because there's no existing kind of markers of credibility, sort of prima facie, you have to kind of develop your own heuristics for who's level-headed, who's serious, who's like paying attention to details, who's sober-minded, and you just have to like, you know, treat that over time. So I have a list of those folks on the UAP list. Some of them, you know, they have their own, you know, everyone has their own idiosyncratic belief systems, but you kind of have to cast a wide net and then treat everything you see with a grain of salt. And I just say would also just pay attention to what is happening formally, right? Like read the National Defense Authorization Act language. I think there's a gentleman on Twitter, Doug Johnson. He's, you know, a serious guy. He tracks kind of the legislative side of this stuff. And so I tweeted out, he wrote a kind of a good summary of what the state of play is in the on Capitol Hill. And his past pieces have done a good job kind of unpacking the various kind of National Defense Authorization Act and other related sort of legislative maneuvers on this stuff, which, you know, that to me is, you know, it's more opaque. It's not very explicit, but if you actually just go read what's already in law in National Defense Authorization Act, like that's where you start. You start in the clearing. You start with the things that are just basic facts, like what is currently in law that relates to UAPs. What government reports have been written. I mean, if you really like want to go into the subject, right, there's like tons of stuff that's been published officially from the government over decades. You know, like the allegation is that those things were all part of disinformation, et cetera, like Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book, all that stuff, Condon Report, Robinson Panel, all that stuff is kind of, you know, in the legacy lore. Yeah, but I wouldn't say I have like, there's a divining rod for what's true here. I mean, that's kind of the challenge with the whole subject is, it is, as I think in my tweet earlier, it's like a miasma, it's a cloud where you have people that are just straight up grifters, you have people that are, you know, that are liars, you have people that are honest truth seekers, you have people that are, you know, just skeptic minded, you know, sober people, you have, you know, the whole gamut. And I think you just have to come up with your own attitude. But I would just sort of look at what's happening, you know, in the more official channels, right? So Grush to me is a sea change where for decades, this topic was just as good as whoever kind of leaked some story. And then everyone, you know, wrote the same kind of fantasy novels, basically, right? There's very little hard facts, or at least facts that were not contested. And hopefully we'll be getting more uncontested facts. And that's kind of where I just hope we get with Congress, is if they could actually just get folks on the record, we get program documents, we get things that are, you know, presented as formal pieces of evidence in authoritative settings like Inspector General investigations and Senate Select Committee intelligence investigations. Like that to me is ultimately where we're going to have to resolve this, is, you know, not on a Twitter space, but like, you know, the institutions of government accountability, bringing their forces of power to bear. So that's where I would go. Yeah. But like professionally, I just pay attention to this because it's like an interesting thing that could come out of that left side of the probability distribution that I want to be at least be mentally prepared for if it does start to spill out into public discourse in a bigger way.
Got it. Well, thank you so much, Matt. You know, if there's anything else you want to leave our audience with, feel free. But that was absolutely fascinating and definitely got me more intrigued to keep digging down the UAP rabbit hole for sure. So again, thank you for coming on Cosmic Bitcoin. This was a blast.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris. Feel free to take us out of here, man.
I think that's pretty much it. Looking forward to seeing a bunch of people at Bitcoin Amsterdam, October 12th through the 13th. And then we'd love to see people join us in Nashville next year, next July. So that's pretty much it. Spencer, anything else for you?
No, sir. We're good to roll. Thanks again, y'all. And we will see you next Wednesday for another Cosmic Bitcoin. Appreciate everyone tuning in.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee. A city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. In its inaugural year, Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history. Held from October 12th to the 14th at Westergaas Event Forum, nearly 3,000 attendees jumped at the opportunity to learn, engage, and party with fellow Bitcoiners. 126 brilliant speakers from all over Europe and beyond took the stage to represent different angles and present various perspectives. Offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages, we are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Lock yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.